Again. I know that you're here. You know that I know that you're here. I must speak to you. Still, Harry said nothing. Professor Quirrell hadn't actually said what this was about, and Harry's sunlit morning walk about the forest edge had produced a mood of silence within him. Professor Quirrell took a small step to the left, a step forward, another to the right. He tilted his head with a look of calculation, and then he walked almost directly towards where Harry stood, halted a few paces off, with the sense of doom inflamed to the height of bearability. "Ah, you still resolved upon your course," Professor Quirrell said. "The same course you spoke of yesterday." Again, Harry did not reply. Professor Quirrell sighed. "There is much I have done for you," the man said. "Whatever else you may wonder of me, you cannot deny that. I am calling in some of the debt. Talk to me, Mr. Potter."
"I don't feel like doing this right now,"
Harry thought. Then,
"Oh, right."
2 hours later, after Harry had spun the time turner once, noted down the exact time and memorized his exact location, spent another hour walking, went inside and told Professor McGonagall that he was currently talking to the defense professor in the woods outside Hogwarts, just in case anything happened to him, walked for a further hour, then returned to his original location exactly 1 hour after he had left and spun the time turner again.
"What was that?" Professor Quirrell said, blinking. "Did you just—"
"Nothing important,"
Harry said, without pulling back the hood of his invisibility cloak or taking his hand from his time-turner.
"Yes, I'm still resolved. To be honest, I'm thinking I shouldn't have said anything."
Professor Quirrell inclined his head.
"A sentiment which shall serve you well in life. Is there anything which is liable to change your mind?"
"Professor, if I already knew about the existence of an argument which would change my decision—"
"True, for the likes of us. But you would be surprised how often someone knows what they are waiting to hear, yet must wait to hear it said."
Professor Quirrell shook his head.
"To put this in your terms, there is a true fact, known to me but not to you, of which I would like to convince you, Mr. Potter."
Harry's eyebrows rose, though he realized in the next moment that Professor Quirrell couldn't see.
"That's in my terms, all right. Go ahead."
"The intention you have formed is far more dangerous than you realize."
Replying to this surprising statement did not take much thought on Harry's part.
"Define dangerous, and tell me what you think you know, and how you think you know it."
"Sometimes," said Professor Quirrell, "telling someone about a danger can cause them to walk directly into it. I have no intention of having that happen this time. Do you expect me to tell you exactly what you must not do? Exactly why I am afraid?"
The man shook his head.
"If you were wizard born, Mr. Potter, you would know to take it seriously when a powerful magus tells you only to beware."
It would have been a lie to say that Harry was not annoyed, but he also wasn't an idiot. So Harry said merely,
"Is there anything you can tell me?"
Carefully, Professor Quirrell seated himself upon the grass and took out his wand, his hand assuming a position that Harry recognized. Harry's breath caught.
"This is the last time that I shall be able to do this for you," Professor Quirrell said quietly. Then the man began to speak words that were strange. Of no language Harry could recognize, intonation that seemed not quite human, words which seemed to slip from Harry's memory even as he tried to grasp them, exiting from his mind as quickly as they entered. The spell took effect more slowly this time. The trees seemed to darken, branches and leaves staining, as though seen through perfect sunglasses that faded and attenuated light without distorting it. The blue bowl of the sky receded, the horizon which Harry's brain falsely assigned a finite distance pulling back as it turned grey and darker grey. The clouds became translucent, transparent, wisping away to let the darkness shine through. The forest shaded, faded, abated into blackness. The great sky river became visible once again as Harry's eyes adjusted, became able to see the largest object which human eyes could ever behold as more than a point. The surrounding Milky Way, and the stars, piercingly bright and yet remote, out of a great depth. Professor Quirrell breathed deeply. Then he raised his wand again, just barely visible in the starlight, without sun or moon, and tapped himself on the head with a sound like an egg cracking. The defense professor also faded away, becoming likewise invisible. A tiny disk of grass, illuminated by not much light at all, drifted, unoccupied within empty space. Neither of them spoke for a time. Harry was content to look at the stars, undistracted even by his own body. Whatever Professor Quirrell had called him here to say, it would be said in due time. In due time, a voice spoke. "There is no war here," said a soft voice emanating from within the emptiness. "No conflict and battle, no politics and betrayal, no death and no life. That is all for the folly of men. The stars are above such foolishness, untouched by it. Here there is peace and silence eternal. So I once thought."
Harry turned to look at where the voice originated and saw only stars.
"So you once thought?" Harry said, when no other words seemed to be forthcoming.
"There is nothing above the folly of men," whispered the voice from the emptiness. "There is nothing beyond the destructive powers of sufficiently intelligent idiocy, not even the stars themselves. I went to a great deal of trouble to make a certain golden plaque last forever. I would not like to see it destroyed by human folly."
Again, Harry's eyes reflexively darted toward where the voice should have been. Again, saw only emptiness.
"I think I can reassure you on that score, Professor. Nuclear weapons don't have a fireball extending out for... how far away is Pioneer 11? Somewhere around 1 billion kilometers, maybe. Muggles talk about nuclear weapons destroying the world, but what they actually mean is lightly warming up some of Earth's surface. The sun is a giant fusion reaction, and it doesn't vaporize distant space probes. The worst-case scenario for nuclear war wouldn't even come close to destroying the solar system. Not that it's much of a consolation.
True, while we speak of muggles, said the soft voice amid starlight. But what do muggles know of true power? It is not they who frighten me now. It is you.
Professor, Harry said carefully, while I have to admit I've rolled a few critical failures in my life, there's a bit of a distance between that and missing a saving throw so hard that the Pioneer 11 probe gets caught in the blast radius. There's no realistic way to do that without blowing up the sun. And before you ask, our sun is a main-sequence G-type star. It can't explode. Any energy input would just increase the volume of the hydrogen plasma. The sun doesn't have a degenerate core that could be detonated. The sun doesn't have enough mass to go supernova, even at the end of its lifespan.
Such amazing things the muggles have learned, the other voice murmured. How stars live, how they are preserved from death, how they die. And they never wonder if such knowledge might be dangerous.
In all frankness, Professor, that particular thought has never occurred to me either.
You are muggle-born. I speak not of blood. I speak of how you spent your childhood years. There is a freedom of thought in that, true. But there is also wisdom in the caution of wizard kind. It has been 323 years since the magical territories of Sicily were ruined by one man's folly. Such incidents were more common in the years when Hogwarts was raised, commoner still in the aftertime of Merlin. Of the time before Merlin, little remains to study.
There's around 30 orders of magnitude of difference between that and blowing up the sun, Harry observed, then caught himself. But that's a pointless quibble. Sorry. Blowing up a country would also be bad, I agree. In any case, Professor, I don't plan on doing anything like that.
Your choice is not required, Mr. Bodder. If you had read more wizard-born novels and fewer muggle stories, you would know. In serious literature, the wizard whose foolishness threatens to unleash the shambling bone men will not be deliberately bent on such a goal. That is for children's books. This truly dangerous wizard shall perhaps be bent on some project of which he anticipates great renown, and the certain prospect of losing that renown and living out his life in obscurity will seem to him more vivid than the unknown prospect of destroying his country. Or he shall have promised success to one he cannot bear to disappoint. Perhaps he has children in debt. There is much literary wisdom in those stories. It is born of harsh experience and cities of ash. The most likely prospect for disaster is a powerful wizard who, for whatever reason, cannot bring himself to halt as warning signs appear. Though he may speak much and loudly of caution, he will not be able to bring himself actually to halt. I wonder, Mr. Potter, have you thought of trying anything which Hermione Granger herself would have told you not to do?
All right, point taken,
said Harry.
"Professor, I am well aware that if I save Hermione at the price of two other people's lives, I've lost on total points from a utilitarian standpoint. I am extremely aware that Hermione would not want me to risk destroying a whole country just to save her. That's just common sense."
"Child who destroys Dementors," said that soft voice. "If it were only one country I feared you might ruin, I would be less concerned. I did not at first credit that your knowledge of Muggle science and Muggle practices would be a source of great power. I now credit it more. I am, in complete sincerity, concerned for the safety of that golden plaque."
"Well, if science fiction has taught me anything," said Harry, "it's taught me that destroying the solar system is not morally acceptable, especially if you do it before humanity has colonized any other star systems."
"Then you will give up this..."
No,
Harry said, without even thinking before he opened his mouth. After a moment he added,
"But, I do understand what you're trying to tell me."
Silence. The stars had not shifted, not even as they would have in an earthly night sky over time. A very slight rustle, as of someone shifting their body. Harry realized that he'd been standing for a while in the same position and dropped down to the almost unseeable circle of grass that still stayed beneath him, careful not to touch the edges of the spell.
"Tell me this," said the soft voice. "Why does that girl matter to you so much?"
"Because she is my friend."
"In the English language, as it is customarily used, Mr. Potter, the word friend is not associated with a desperate effort to raise the dead. Are you under the impression that she is your true love, or some such?"
"Oh, not you, too,"
Harry said wearily.
"Not you, of all people, Professor. Fine, we're best friends, but that's all, okay? That's enough. Friends don't let friends stay dead."
"Ordinary folk do not do as much for those they call friends."
The voice sounded more distant now, abstracted.
"Not even for those they say they love. Their companions die, and they do not go in search of power to resurrect them."
Harry couldn't help himself. He looked over again, despite knowing it would be futile, and saw only more stars.
"Let me guess. From this you deduce that people don't actually care as much about their friends as they pretend."
A brief laugh.
"They would scarcely pretend to care less."
"They care, Professor. And not just for their true loves. Soldiers throw themselves on grenades to save their friends. Mothers run into burning houses to save their children. But if you're a Muggle, you don't think there's any such thing as magic to bring someone back to life. And normal wizards don't think outside the box like that. I mean, most wizards aren't searching for power to make themselves immortal. Does that prove they don't care about their own lives?"
"As you say, Mr. Potter, certainly I myself would consider their lives pointless and without a shred of value. Perhaps somewhere in their hidden hearts, they also believe that my opinion of them is the correct one."
Harry shook his head, and then, in annoyance, cast back the hood of his cloak, and shook his head again.
"That seems like a rather contrived view of the world, Professor,"
said the dim-lit head of a boy, floating unsupported on a circle of dark grass amid stars.
"Trying to invent a resurrection spell just isn't something normal people would think of, so you can't deduce anything from their not taking the option."
A moment later, the dim-lit outline of a man sitting on the circle of grass was visible as well.
"If they truly cared about their supposed loved ones," the defense professor said softly, "they would think of it, would they not?"
"Brains don't work that way. They don't suddenly supercharge when the stakes go up. Or when they do, it's within hard limits. I couldn't calculate the 1,000th digit of pi if someone's life depended on it."
The dim-lit head inclined.
"But that is another possible explanation, Mr. Potter. It is that people play the role of friendship. They do just as much as that role requires of them, and no more. The thought occurs to me that perhaps the difference between you and them is not that you care more than they do. Why would you have been born with such unusual strong emotions of friendship that you alone among wizard kind are driven to resurrect Hermione Granger after her death? No, the most likely difference is not that you care more. It is that, being a more logical creature than they, you alone have thought that playing the role of friend would require this of you."
Harry stared out at the stars. He would have been lying if he had claimed not to be shaken.
"That can't be true, Professor. I could name a dozen examples in Muggle novels of people driven to resurrect their dead friends. The authors of those stories clearly understood exactly how I feel about Hermione, though you wouldn't have read them, I guess. Maybe Orpheus and Eurydice. I didn't actually read that one, but I know what's in it."
"Such tales are also told among wizard kind. There is the story of the Elric brothers, the tale of Dora Kent, who was protected by her son Saul. There is Ronald Mallet and his doomed challenge to time. In Sicily, before its fall, the drama of Precia Testarossa. In Nippon, they tell of Akimi Homura and her lost love. What these stories have in common, Mr. Potter, is that they're all fiction. Real-life wizards do not attempt the same, even though the notion is clearly not beyond their imagination."
"Because they don't think they can."
Harry's voice rose.
"Shall we go and tell the good Professor McGonagall about your intention to find a way to resurrect Miss Granger, and see what she thinks of it? Perhaps it has simply never occurred to her to consider that option. Ah, but you hesitate. You already know her answer, Mr. Potter. Do you know why you know it?"
You could hear the cold smile in the voice.
"A lovely technique, that. Thank you for teaching it to me."
Harry was aware of the tension that had developed in his face. His words came out as though bitten off.
"Professor McGonagall has not grown up with the Muggle concept of the increasing power of science, and nobody's ever told her that when a friend's life is at stake, it's a time when you need to think very rationally."
The defense professor's voice was also rising.
The Transfiguration Professor is reading from a script, Mr. Potter. That script calls for her to mourn and grieve, that all may know how much she cared. Ordinary people react poorly if you suggest that they go off-script, as you already knew.
That's funny. I could have sworn I saw Professor McGonagall going off-script at dinner yesterday. If I saw her go off-script another 10 times, I might actually try to talk to her about resurrecting Hermione. But right now, she's new to that and needs practice. In the end, Professor, what you're trying to explain away by calling love and friendship and everything else a lie is just human beings not knowing any better.
The defense professor's voice rose in pitch.
If it were you who had been killed by that troll, it would not even occur to Hermione Granger to do as you are doing for her. It would not occur to Draco Malfoy, nor to Neville Longbottom, nor to McGonagall, or any of your precious friends. There is not one person in this world who would return to you the care that you are showing her. So why? Why do it, Mr. Potter?
There was a strange, wild desperation in that voice.
Why be the only one in the world who goes to such lengths to keep up the pretense, when none of them will ever do the same for you?
I believe you are factually mistaken, Professor,
Harry returned evenly.
About a number of things, in fact. At the very least, your model of my emotions is flawed. Because you don't understand me the tiniest bit if you think that it would stop me if everything you said was true. Everything in the world has to start somewhere. Every event that happens has to happen for the first time. Life on Earth had to start with some little self-replicating molecule in a pool of mud. And if I were the first person in the world... No.
Harry's hand swept out to indicate the terribly distant points of light.
If I were the first person in the universe who ever really cared about someone else, which I'm not, by the way, then I'd be honored to be that person and try to do it justice.
There was a long silence.
You truly do care about that girl,
the man's dim outline said softly.
You care about her in the way that none of them are capable of caring for their own lives, let alone each other.
The defense professor's voice had become strange, filled with some indecipherable emotion.
I do not understand it. But I know the lengths you will go to because of it. You will challenge death itself for her. Nothing will sway you from that.
I care enough to make an actual effort,
Harry said quietly.
Yes, that is correct.
The starlight slowly began to fracture, the world shining through the cracks. Slashes through the night showing tree trunks and leaves glowing in the sunlight. Harry raised a hand, blinking hard as the returning brightness smashed into his dark-adjusted eyes, and his eyes automatically went to the defense professor, just in case an attack occurred while he was blinded. When all the stars had gone and only daylight remained, Professor Quirrell was still sitting on the grass.
"Well, Mr. Potter," he said in his normal voice, "if that is so, then I shall give you what help I can while I can."
"You'll what?"
Harry said involuntarily.
My offer, as I made it yesterday, still stands. Ask, and I will answer. Show me the same science books you deemed suitable for Mr. Malfoy, and I shall look them over and tell you what comes to mind. Don't look so surprised, Mr. Potter. I would hardly leave you to your own devices.
Harry stared, tear duct still watering from the sunlight. Professor Quirrell looked back at him. Something strange glinted in the pale eyes.
I have done what I can, and now I fear I must take my leave of you. Good,
and the defense professor hesitated.
Good day, Mr. Potter.
Good,
Harry began. The man sitting on the grass fell over, his head impacting the ground with a light thud. At the same time, the sense of doom diminished so sharply that Harry leapt to his feet, his heart suddenly in his throat. But the figure on the ground slowly pushed back up to a crawling position, turned to look at Harry, eyes empty, mouth slack, tried to stand, fell back to the ground. Harry took a step forward, sheer instinct telling him to offer a hand, although that was incorrect. The apprehension that rose up in him, however faint, spoke of continued danger. But the fallen figure flinched away from Harry, and then slowly began to crawl away from him in the general direction of the distant castle. The boy, standing amid the forest, gazed after. Chapter 96. Rolls, Part 7.
The fourth meeting. 4:38 p.m., April 17th, 1992.
The man wearing the worn, warm coat with three faint scars etched forever into his cheek observed Harry Potter as closely as he could, while the boy looked around politely at the rows of cottages. For someone whose best friend had died yesterday, Harry Potter seemed strangely composed, though not in any way reminiscent of unfeelingness or normality.
"I don't wish to talk about that," the boy had said. "With you or anyone."
Saying wish and not want, as though to emphasize that he was able to use grown-up words and make grown-up decisions. There had been only one thing Remus Lupin had thought of that might help, after he'd received the owls from Professor McGonagall, and that strange man, Quirinus Quirrell.
"There's a lot of empty houses," the boy said, glancing around again.
Godric's Hollow had changed in the decades since Remus Lupin had been a frequent visitor. Many of the old, peaked cottages looked deserted, with green, leafy vines growing across their windows and their doors. Britain had contracted noticeably in the aftermath of the Wizarding War, having lost not only the dead, but the fled. Godric's Hollow had been hard hit, and afterward still more families had moved elsewhere, to Hogsmeade or magical London, the deserted houses too uncomfortable a reminder. Others had remained. Godric's Hollow was older than Hogwarts, older than Godric Gryffindor, whose name it had taken, and there were families which would reside here until the end of the world and its magic. The Potters had been one such family, and would be again, if the last Potter so chose. Remus Lupin tried to explain all that, simplifying it as best he could for the young boy.
The Ravenclaw nodded thoughtfully and said nothing, as though he had understood it all without need of questions. Perhaps that was so. The child of James Potter and Lily Evans, the head boy and head girl of Hogwarts, would hardly be stupid. The child had certainly seemed highly intelligent, for the little time they had spoken in January, though at the time Remus had done most of the talking. There was also that business with the Wizengamot which Remus had heard rumours about, but Remus didn't believe a single word of that, any more than he believed it about James betrothing his son to Molly's youngest.
"There's a monument," Remus said, pointing ahead of them.
Harry walked beside Mr. Lupin toward the black marble obelisk, thinking silently. It seemed to Harry that this adventure was essentially misguided. He had no use for grief counselling. That was not Harry's chosen path. So far as Harry was concerned, the five stages of grief were rage, remorse, resolve, research, and resurrection. Not that the usual five stages of grief had any experimental evidence whatsoever that Harry had ever heard about. But Mr. Lupin had seemed too sincere to refuse, and visiting James and Lily's home was something Harry felt he ought not to turn down. So Harry walked, feeling oddly detached, walking silently through a play whose script he was not interested in reading. Harry had been told that he wasn't to wear the Cloak of Invisibility for this journey, so that Mr. Lupin could keep track of him. Harry was morally certain that Dumbledore, or both Dumbledore and Mad-Eye Moody, were following them invisibly to see if anyone tried for the bait. There was no way Harry would have been let out of Hogwarts with only Remus Lupin for a guard. Harry didn't expect anything to happen, though. He'd seen nothing to contradict the hypothesis that all the danger centred on Hogwarts, and only Hogwarts. As the two of them walked closer toward the centre of town, the marble obelisk transformed into... Harry drew in a breath. He'd been expecting a heroic pose of James Potter, with wand levelled against Lord Voldemort, and Lily Potter, with arms outstretched in front of the crib. Instead, there was a man with untidy hair and glasses, and a woman with her hair let down and a baby in her arms. And that was all.
"It looks very... normal," Harry said, feeling an odd catch in his throat.
"Madam Longbottom and Professor Dumbledore put their foot down hard," said Mr. Lupin, who was looking more at Harry than at the monument. "They said that the Potters should be remembered as they had lived, not as they had died."
Harry looked at the statue, thinking. Very strange, to see himself as a baby of stone with no scar upon his forehead. It was a glimpse at an alternate universe, one where Harry James Potter, no, Evans Verus to his name, became an intelligent but ordinary wizarding scholar. Maybe sorted into Gryffindor like his parents. A Harry Potter who grew up a proper young wizard, knowing little of science for all that his mother was muggle-born. Ultimately changing... not much. James and Lily wouldn't have raised their son with what Professor Quirrell would have called ambition, and what Professor Verus Evans would have called the common endeavour. His birth parents would have loved him very much, and that would not have been much help to anyone in the world except Harry. If someone had undone their death,
"You were their friend," Harry said, turning to look at Lupin. "For a long time. Since you were children."
Mr. Lupin nodded silently. Professor Quirrell's voice resounded in Harry's approximate memory.
"The most likely difference is not that you care more. Rather, it is that, being a more logical creature than they, only you are aware that the role of friend ought to require this of you."
"When Lily and James died," Harry said, "did you think at all of whether there might be some magical way to get them back, like Orpheus and Eurydice, or the, what was it, Elrin brothers?"
"There is no magic which can undo death," Mr. Lupin said quietly. "There are some mysteries which wizardry cannot touch."
"Did you do a mental check of what you thought you knew, how you thought you knew it, and how high the probability was of that conclusion?"
"What?" said Mr. Lupin. "Could you repeat that, Harry?"
"I'm saying, did you think about it anyway?"
Mr. Lupin shook his head.
"Why not?"
"Because it was already done and over,"
Remus Lupin said gently.
"Because wherever James and Lily are now, they would wish me to act for the sake of the living, not the dead."
Harry nodded silently. He had been pretty sure of the answer to that question before he had asked. He had already read that script. But he'd asked it anyway, just in case Mr. Lupin had spent a week obsessing about it, because Harry could have been wrong. The soft voice of the defense professor seemed to speak in Harry's mind.
"Surely, if Lupin truly cared, he would not need special instruction for something as simple as thinking for 5 minutes before giving up."
"Yes, he would," Harry answered the mental voice. "Human beings wouldn't suddenly obtain a skill like that just because they cared. I learned about it because I read library books produced by a huge scientific edifice."
And that other part of Harry said, in that soft voice,
"But there is also another hypothesis, Mr. Potter, and it fits the data in a much less complicated way."
"No, it doesn't. How would people even know what to pretend if nobody had ever cared?"
"They don't know. That is what you observe."
The two of them walked onward toward a certain house, past a long row of occupied wizard cottages and other cottages overgrown with vines, coming finally to the house with half its top blown off and green leaves growing over into the inside, behind a shoulder-high, wild-growing hedge lining the sidewalk and a narrow metal gate. Mr. Hagrid had probably stepped right over it, being unable to fit through. The gap in the roof was like a giant mouth had taken a circular bite from the house, leaving spines of wood, what had maybe been support beams, sticking out. To the right side, a single chimney stood upright, uneaten by the giant bite, but leaning dangerously without its former support. Windows were shattered. Where there should have been a front door were only splinters of wood. To this place Lord Voldemort had come, silently, making less noise than the dead leaves slithering along the pavement. Remus Lupin put a hand upon Harry's shoulder.
"Touch the gate," Mr. Lupin urged.
Harry reached out a hand and did so.
Like a fast-growing flower, a sign burst from the tangled weeds in the ground behind the gate. A wooden sign with golden letters, and it said,
"On this spot, on the night of the 31st of October, 1981, Lily and James Potter lost their lives. They were survived by their son, Harry Potter, the only wizard ever to withstand the killing curse. The boy who lived, who broke you-know-whose power."
This house had been left in its ruined state as a monument to the Potters, as a reminder of their sacrifice. In a blank space below the golden letters were written other messages, dozens of them, magical ink that rose to the surface and gleamed brightly enough to be read before fading and giving way to other messages.
"So my Gideon is avenged."
"Thank you, Harry Potter. Farewell, wherever you are. We will always be in the Potter's debt."
"Oh, James. Oh, Lily, I am sorry."
"I hope you're alive, Harry Potter. There is always a price."
"I wish our last words had been kinder, James. I'm sorry.
There's always a dawn after the night."
"Rest well, Lily."
"Bless you, boy who lived. You were our miracle."
"I guess," Harry said, I guess that's what people do. Instead of trying to make it better..."
Harry stopped. The thought seemed unworthy of this place. He looked up and saw Remus Lupin gazing at him with a look so gentle that Harry wrenched his eyes away to the blasted and broken roof.
"You were our miracle."
Harry had always heard the word miracle in the context of how, in the natural universe, there was no such thing. And yet, looking at the ruined house, he suddenly knew exactly what the word meant. The note of grace, all unexplained. The blessing, inexplicable. The Dark Lord had almost won. And then, in one night, all the darkness and terror had ended. Salvation, without justification. A sudden dawn from out of the darkness, and even now, nobody knew why. If Lily Potter had lived beyond her confrontation with Lord Voldemort, she would have felt that way when she saw her baby alive afterward.
"Let's go,"
whispered the baby boy 10 years later. They went. The graveyard's entrance was guarded by a lockless gate of the sort that kept out animals, with a place to stand while you moved the door from one side of the standing place to the other. Remus took out his wand, Harry was already holding his, and there was a brief blur as they stepped through. Some of the stones rising up from the ground looked as old as the wall in Oxford that his father had said was around 1,000 years old. "Hayley Fleming," said the first stone that Harry saw, in a carving almost invisibly faded with the erosion of time. "Vienna wood," said another. It had been a long time since Harry had visited a graveyard. His mind had still been childlike the last time he had come to one, long before he had seen within death's shadow. Coming here now was strange and sad and puzzling. And this had been happening for so long. Why haven't wizards tried to stop it? Why aren't they putting all their strength into that, like muggles do with magical research? Only more so. Wizards have more reason to hope.
"The Dumbledores lived in Godric's Hollow too,"
Harry said as they walked past a pair of relatively new stones saying Kendra Dumbledore and
Ariana Dumbledore.
For a long, long time, Mr. Lupin said.
They walked further into the graveyard, far toward the end, past many deaths that had been mourned. Then Mr. Lupin pointed at a linked double headstone of marble, still white and unaged.
"Are there going to be messages there?"
Harry said. He didn't want to deal any more with the way that other people dealt with death. Mr. Lupin shook his head. They walked toward the linked white stones, and stood before...
"What is this?"
Harry whispered.
Who wrote this?
James Potter, born 27th of March, 1960. Died 31st of October, 1981.
Wrote what? Said Mr. Lupin, puzzled.
Lily Potter, born 30th of January, 1960. Died 31st of October, 1981.
This! Harry cried. The inscription!
There were tears welling up in Harry's eyes, at the brightness, out of place and unexplained, the touch of grace where no grace should have been, the mysterious blessing, tears welling up at...
The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death.
That, Mr. Lupin said, that's the motto, I suppose you could call it, of the Potters, though I don't think it was ever something as formal as that, just a saying handed down from long, long ago.
This, that...
Harry scrambled down to kneel beside the grave, touched the inscription with a trembling hand.
Ow! Things like that can't just be... genetic!
Then Harry saw what tears had blurred, the faint carving of a line within a circle, within a triangle. The symbol of the Deathly Hallows... And Harry understood.
They tried,
Harry whispered.
The three Beverell brothers.
Had they lost someone precious to them? Was that where it had begun?
With all their lives, they tried. And they made progress.
The cloak of invisibility that could defeat the Dementor's sight.
But their research wasn't finished.
Hiding from death's shadow is not defeating death itself. The Resurrection Stone couldn't really bring anyone back. The Elder Wand couldn't protect you from old age.
So they passed on the mission to their children, and their children's children.
Generation after generation.
Until it came to me.
Could time echo like that? Rhyming between this far into the future and that far into the past? It couldn't be coincidence. Could it? Not this message. Not in this place.
My family. You really were my mother and father.
It doesn't mean resurrecting the dead, Harry,
Mr. Lupin said.
It means accepting death and so being beyond death, mastering it.
Did James tell you that?
Harry said, his voice strange.
No, said Mr. Lupin. But...
good.
Harry rose up slowly from where he had been kneeling, feeling as though he were pushing up a sun upon his shoulders, raising the dawn above the horizon.
"Of course other wizards have tried. I'm not unique. I was never alone. These feelings in my heart, they're not so special. Not in the wizard world, or the muggle one."
"Harry, your wand!"
There was a sudden excitement in Mr. Lupin's voice, and when Harry raised his wand to look at it closely, he saw that it was gleaming ever so faintly with a silver light welling out of the wood.
"Cast the Patronus charm," urged Mr. Lupin. "Try casting it again, Harry."
"Oh, right. So far as Mr. Lupin knows, I can't."
Harry smiled, and even laughed a little.
"I better not," Harry said. "If I tried to cast the spell in this state of mind, it'd probably kill me."
"What?" said Mr. Lupin. "The Patronus charm doesn't do that."
Harry James Potter, Evans Veris, raised his left hand, still laughing, and wiped away some more tears.
"You know, Mr. Lupin," Harry said, "it really takes a baroque interpretation to think that somebody would be walking around, pondering how death is just something we all have to accept, and communicate their state of mind by saying, 'The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death.' Maybe someone else thought it sounded poetic and picked up the phrase and tried to interpret it differently. But whoever said it first didn't like death much."
Sometimes it puzzled Harry how most people didn't seem to even notice when they were twisting something around to the 180-degree opposite of its first obvious reading. It couldn't be a raw brain power thing. People could see the obvious reading of most other English sentences.
"Also, shall be destroyed refers to a change of future state, so it can't be about the way things are now."
Remus Lupin was staring at him with wide eyes.
"You certainly are James and Lily's child," the man said, sounding rather shocked.
"Yes, I am," Harry said.
But that wasn't enough. He had to do something more. So Harry raised his wand in the air and said, his voice as steady as he could make it,
"I am Harry James Potter Evans Veris, the son of Lily and James of the House of Potter, and I accept my family's quest. Death is my enemy, and I will defeat it."
"Threan ben pevelas, sona am thril hira, tol thisum doth be unen."
"What?"
Harry said aloud. The words had popped up into his stream of consciousness, as though from his own thoughts, unexplained.
"What was that?" said Remus Lupin at the same time.
Harry turned, scanning the graveyard, but he didn't see anything. Beside him, Mr. Lupin was doing the same. Neither of them noticed the tall stone, worn as though from 1,000 years of age, upon it a line within a circle, within a triangle, glowing ever so faintly silver, like the light which had shone from Harry's wand, invisible at that distance beneath the still bright sun.
Some time later.
"Thank you again, Mr. Lupin," Harry said. The tall, faintly scarred man was about to depart once more.
"Though I really wish you hadn't."
"Professor Dumbledore said that I was to port Chaos back to Hogwarts if anything unusual happened, whether or not it seemed like an attack,"
Mr. Lupin said firmly.
"Which is eminently sensible."
Harry nodded, and then, having carefully saved this question for last,
"Do you have any idea of what the words meant?"
"If I did, I wouldn't tell you,"
Mr. Lupin said, looking rather severe.
"Certainly not without Professor Dumbledore's permission. I can understand your eagerness, but you should not go trying to uncover any ancestral secrets of the Potters until you are an adult. That means after you've passed your NEWTs, Harry, or at least your OWLs. And I still think you've picked up entirely the wrong idea of what your family motto is meant to say."
Harry nodded, sighing internally, and bid Mr. Lupin farewell. Harry went back through Hogwarts to the Ravenclaw Tower, feeling strange and strengthened. He would not have expected any of that, but it had been all to the good. He was passing through the Ravenclaw common room on the way to his dorm. That was when the shining creature came to him, gleaming soft white beneath the candle fires of the Ravenclaw common room as it slithered out from nowhere. The Silver Snake.
"Thrigen Bion, Pifieles Suna, and Prihira Tol Thissum, Dead Bio Gewenen."
Spoken in the presence of the three Peverell brothers, in a small tavern on the outskirts of what would later be called Godric's Hollow. Chapter 97. Rolls, Part 8. For the second time that day, Harry's eyes filled with tears. Heedless of the puzzled eyes of the Ravenclaws in the common room, he reached out to the silver creature which Draco Malfoy had sent, cradling it in his arms like a living thing, and stumbled off in the direction of his dorm room, heading half-blindly for the bottom of his trunk as the silver snake waited silently in his arms.
The fifth meeting, 10:12 a.m., Sunday, April 19th.
The debtors' meeting, which Lord Malfoy had demanded from Harry Potter, who owed Lucius Malfoy a debt of some 58,203 galleons, was held within the Gringotts Central Bank, in accordance with the laws of Britain. There had been some pushback from the chief warlock Dumbledore, trying to prevent Harry Potter from leaving the security of Hogwarts, a phrase that caused Harry Potter to raise his fingers and silently make quote marks in the air. For his own part, the boy who lived had seemingly pondered quietly, and then assented to the meeting, strangely compliant in the face of his enemy's demand. The headmaster of Hogwarts, who acted as Harry Potter's legal guardian in the eyes of magical Britain, had overruled his ward's assent. The debts committee of the Wizengamot had overruled the headmaster of Hogwarts. The chief warlock had overruled the debts committee. The Wizengamot had overruled the chief warlock. And so, the boy who lived had departed under the heavy guard of Mad-Eye Moody and an aura trio for the Gringotts Central Bank. With Moody's bright blue eye rotating wildly in every direction, as though to signal to any possible attacker that he was on guard and constantly vigilant, and would cheerfully incinerate the kidneys of anyone who sneezed in the general direction of the boy who lived. Harry Potter watched more keenly than before as they marched through the wide open front doors of Gringotts, beneath the motto, "Fortius quo fidelius." On Harry's last three visits to Gringotts, he had merely admired the marble pillars, the gold-burning torchlights, the architecture,
not quite like the human parts of magical Britain. Since then had come the incident at Azkaban, and other things. And now, on his fourth visit, Harry was thinking about goblin rebellions, and goblins' ongoing resentment at not being allowed to own wands, and certain facts which hadn't been in the first-year history textbook, which Harry had guessed at by pattern-matching, and which Professor Flitwick had confirmed in a very quiet voice. Lord Voldemort had killed goblins as well as wizards. An incredibly stupid move on Lord Voldemort's part, unless Harry was really missing something. But what goblins thought of the boy who lived, Harry had no idea. Goblins had a reputation for paying what they owed, and taking what they thought owed them, along with a reputation for interpreting those accounts in a somewhat prejudiced fashion. Today, the guards standing upright in armour at regular intervals around the bank were staring at the boy who lived with blank faces, and glaring at Moody and the Aurors with flashes of bitter contempt. At the stands and counters of the bank's foyer, goblin tellers stared with equal contempt at the wizards, whose hands they were filling with galleons. One teller smiled a sharp-toothed grin at a witch who was looking angry and desperate.
"If I understand human nature correctly, and if I'm right that all the humanoid magical species are genetically human, plus a heritable magical effect, then you're not likely to become friends with a wizard just because I'm polite to you, or say that I'm sympathetic. But I wonder if you would back the boy who lived in a bid to overthrow the ministry, if I promised to revoke the wand law afterward. Or if I quietly gave you wands and spellbooks in exchange for your support. Is that why the secret of wand-making is restricted to people like Ollivander? Though, if you really are human, just plain human, then the goblin nation probably has its own internal horrors, its own Azkabans, for that is also human nature. In which case, sooner or later I must overthrow or reform your own government as well.
An aged goblin appeared before them, and Harry inclined his head with careful courtesy, a gesture that the aged goblin returned with an abrupt half-nod. There was no wild train ride. Instead, the aged goblin ushered them into a short hallway that terminated in a small waiting room with three goblin-sized benches and one wizard-sized chair within which nobody sat.
"Do not join anything that Lucius Malfoy gives you,"
Mad-Eye Moody said.
"Nothing. Do you understand me, lad? If Malfoy hands you a copy of The Wonderful Adventures of the Boy Who Lived and asks you for an autograph, tell him that you've sprained a finger. Don't pick up a quill for a single second while you're in Gringotts. If someone hands you a quill, break the quill, and then break your own fingers. Do I need to explain further, son?"
"Not particularly," Harry said. "We also have lawyers in Muggle Britain, and they'd think your lawyers are cute."
A short time later, Harry Potter handed his wand over to an armoured goblin guard who frisked him with all manner of interesting-looking probes, and gave his pouch to Moody to keep. And then Harry stepped through another door, and a brief waterfall of Thief's Downfall, which evaporated from his skin as soon as he stepped out. On the other side of the door was a larger room, richly panelled and appointed, with a great golden table stretching across it. Two huge leather chairs on one side of the table, and a small wooden stool on the other. The debtor's perch. Two goblins in full armour, wearing ornate earpieces and glasses, stood watch around the room.
neither side would have wands or any other device of magic, and the goblin guards would attack immediately if anyone dared to use wandless magic within this peaceable meeting supervised by Gringotts Bank. The ornate earpieces would prevent the goblin guards from hearing the conversation unless directly addressed. The eyepieces would leave the wizards' faces as blurs. It was, in short, something along the lines of actual security. At least, if you are an oculomance. Harry climbed up onto his uncomfortable wooden stool, thinking, "Subtle," in a tone of some mental sarcasm, and awaited his creditors. It was only a brief interval later, much shorter than the time a debtor could legally be made to wait, when Lucius Malfoy entered into the room, taking up his leather chair with motions worn smooth by practice. His snake-headed cane was missing from his hands, his long white mane drifted behind him the same as ever. His face could not be read. Quietly following behind him was a young boy with white blonde hair, now wearing black robes far finer than any Hogwarts uniform, who followed in his father's footsteps with a controlled face. A boy who was also Harry's creditor to the tune of 40 galleons, and also of House Malfoy, and therefore, technically, covered by the Wizengamot resolution enabling this meeting.
"Draco!"
Harry didn't say it out loud, didn't let his own expression change. He couldn't think of what to say. Not even, "I'm sorry," seemed appropriate. Harry hadn't dared say any of that to Draco's Patronus either, when they had set up this meeting in a few brief exchanges, and not only because Lucius might be listening. It had been enough to know that Draco's happy thought was still happy, and that he had still been able to want Harry to know it. Lucius Malfoy spoke first, his voice level, his face set.
"I do not understand what is happening at Hogwarts, Harry Potter. Would you care to explain it to me?"
"I don't know," Harry said.
"If I understood these events, I would not have let them happen, Lord Malfoy." "Then answer me this question. Who are you?"
Harry gazed evenly at the face of his creditor.
"I'm not you-know-who, like you thought I was," Harry said. Not being a complete idiot, it eventually worked out who Lucius Malfoy had thought he was talking to in front of the Wizengamot.
"Obviously, I'm not a normal boy. Equally obviously, that probably has something to do with the boy who lived business. But I don't know what, or why, any more than you do. I asked the Sorting Hat, and it didn't know either."
Lucius Malfoy nodded distantly.
"I could not think of any reason why you would pay 100,000 galleons to save a mudblood's life. No reason save one, which would account for her power and bloodthirst alike. But then she died at the hands of a troll, and yet you lived. And also, my son has told me much of you, Harry Potter, which did not make the tiniest bit of sense. I have heard the ravings of the mad in St. Mungo's, and they were more sensible by far than the events which my son told me under Veritaserum that you enacted. And that portion of this raving lunacy which you personally carried out, I would have you explain to me. And now..."
Harry closed his eyes and spoke without looking.
A boy raised by Muggles who thought he was clever. You saw me, Draco, and you thought how very useful it would be if the boy who lived, out of all the other children in your year, could be shown the truth of things, if we could be friends. And I thought the same thing about you. Only you and I believed different things were true. Not that I'm saying that there are different truths. I mean, there's different beliefs, but there's only one reality, only one universe that can make those beliefs true or false. You lied to me.
Harry opened his eyes and looked at Draco.
I would prefer to say, Harry said, not quite with a steady voice, that the things I told you were true from a certain point of view. A certain point of view?
Draco Malfoy looked every bit as angry as Luke Skywalker had had the right to be, and not in a mood to accept Kenobi's excuses either.
There's a word for things that are true from a certain point of view. They're called lies. Or tricks,
Harry said evenly.
Statements which are technically true, but which deceive the listener into forming further beliefs which are false. I think it's worth making that distinction. What I told you was a self-fulfilling prophecy. You believed that you couldn't deceive yourself, so you didn't try. The skills you've learned are real, and it would have been very bad for you to start fighting against them internally. People can't make themselves believe that blue is green by an act of will, but they think they can, and that can be almost as bad.
You used me,
said Draco Malfoy.
I only used you in ways that made you stronger. That's what it means to be used by a friend.
Even I know that's not what friendship is.
Now Lucius Malfoy spoke again.
For what purpose? To what end?
Even the elder Malfoy's voice was not quite steady.
Why?
Harry regarded him for a moment and then turned to Draco.
Your father's probably not going to believe this, Harry said. But you, Draco, should be able to see that everything which has happened is compatible with this hypothesis, and that any more cynical hypothesis wouldn't explain why I didn't press you harder when you thought I had leverage, or why I taught you so much. I thought that the heir of House Malfoy, who'd been publicly seen to grab a Muggle-born girl to stop her falling off the roof of Hogwarts, would be a good compromise candidate to lead magical Britain after the Reformation.
So you would have me believe,
Lucius Malfoy said in a thin voice,
that you are claiming to be mad. Well, let us leave all that aside. Tell me who set that troll on Hogwarts.
I don't know, Harry said.
Tell me who you suspect, Harry Potter.
I have four suspects. One of them is Professor Snape.
Snape?
Draco burst out.
The second, of course, is the defense professor of Hogwarts, just because he's the defense professor.
Harry would have left him out, not wanting to bring Professor Quirrell to the Malfoys' attention if he was innocent, but Draco might have called him on that.
The third you wouldn't believe me about. The fourth is a catch-all category called everything else. And the fifth, Lord Voldemort, I do not think I should name to you.
Lucius Malfoy's face contorted in a snarl.
Do you think I cannot recognize bait upon your hook? Tell me about this third possibility, Potter. The one you wish me to believe is the true answer, and leave aside games."
Harry regarded Lord Malfoy steadily.
"I once read a book I wasn't supposed to read, and it told me this. Communication is an event that takes place between equals. Employees lie to their bosses, who in turn expect to be lied to. I'm not playing coy. I'm observing that it's simply not possible, in our present situation, for me to tell you about the third suspect. You have to believe that my story was anything but a lure."
Draco spoke then.
"It's father, isn't it?"
Harry gave Draco a startled look. Draco spoke evenly.
"You suspect that father sent the troll into Hogwarts to get Granger, don't you? That's what you're thinking, isn't it?"
Harry opened his mouth to say, "Actually, no," and then managed to think ahead and stop himself for once in his life.
"I see," Harry said slowly. "That's what this is about. Lucius Malfoy publicly says that Hermione won't get away with what she's done, and lo and behold, a troll kills her."
Harry smiled then, in a way that bared his teeth.
"And if I deny that here, then Draco, who isn't an Occlumens, can then testify under Veritaserum that the boy who lived does not suspect Lucius Malfoy of having sent a troll into Hogwarts to kill Hermione Granger, sworn to the noble House of Potter, whose blood debt was recently purchased for 100,000 galleons, etc.
Harry leaned back slightly, though his wooden stool had no back with which to do it properly.
"But now that it's been pointed out, I see that it's very reasonable. Obviously, you killed Hermione Granger, just like you threatened to do in front of the whole Wizengamot."
"I did not," Lucius Malfoy said, expressionless once more.
Harry bared his teeth again in that non-smile.
"Well then, in that case, there must be someone else out there who killed Hermione and messed with the Hogwarts wards, the same person who earlier tried to frame Hermione for Draco Malfoy's murder. Either you killed Hermione Granger after being paid for her life, or you blamed your son's attempted murder on an innocent girl and took all my family's money under false pretenses. One of those two things must be true."
"You killed her in hopes of your money being returned."
Lucius Malfoy had leaned forward and was staring hard at Harry.
"Then I would not have given away my money for her in the first place, as you already know. Don't insult my intelligence, Lord Malfoy." No. Wait, sorry. You just had to say that in case Draco had to testify to it. Never mind.
Lucius Malfoy sat back in his chair and stared.
"I tried to tell you, Father,"
Draco said under his breath.
"But nobody can imagine Harry Potter until they've actually met him."
Harry tapped a finger on his cheek.
"So, people are starting to figure out the blatantly obvious. I'm surprised, actually. I wouldn't have predicted that would happen."
Harry had by now caught the general rhythm of Professor Quirrell's cynicism and was able to generate it independently.
"I wouldn't think a newspaper would be able to report on a concept like either X or Y must be true, but we don't know which. I would only expect journalists to report stories consisting of series of atomic propositions like X is true, Y is false, or X is true and Y is false.
not more complex logical connectors like if X is true, then Y is true, but we don't know whether X is true, and all your supporters ought to be rapidly switching between you can't prove that Lord Malfoy killed Granger, it could have been someone else, and you can't prove there was someone else to frame Granger, so long as it's uncertain they should be trying to have it both ways at once. Wait, don't you own the Daily Prophet?
The Daily Prophet,
Lucius Malfoy said thinly,
which I certainly do not own, is far too respectable to publish any such scurrilous nonsense. Unfortunately, not all wizards of influence are so reasonable.
Ah, got it, Harry nodded.
Lucius glanced at Draco.
The rest of what he said, was any of it important?
No, father, it was not.
Thank you, son.
Lucius returned his gaze to Harry. His voice, when he spoke, was something closer to his usual drawl, cool and confident.
It is possible that I could be persuaded to show you some favour, if you admitted before the Wizengamot that you clearly know that I was not responsible for this deed. I would be willing to reduce your remaining debt to House Malfoy quite significantly, or even to adjust the terms to allow later repayment.
Harry regarded Lucius Malfoy steadily.
Lucius Malfoy, you are now perfectly aware that Hermione Granger was, in fact, framed, using your son as bait, that she was false memory charmed, or worse, and that House Potter held nothing against you before that. My counter-proposal is that you return my family's money. I announce before the Wizengamot that House Potter holds House Malfoy no animus, and we present a united front against whoever's doing this. We decide to screw the roles we're supposed to play and ally with each other instead of fighting. It could be the one thing the enemy doesn't expect us to do.
There was a brief silence in the room, except for the two goblin guards who went on breathing regardless.
You are mad,
Lucius Malfoy said coldly.
It's called justice, Lord Malfoy. You cannot possibly expect me to cooperate with you while you're holding the wealth of House Potter under what you know to be false pretenses. I understand how it looked to you at the time, but you know better now.
You have nothing to offer me worth 100,000 galleons.
Don't I?
Harry said distantly.
I wonder. I think it quite probable that you care more about the long-term welfare of House Malfoy than about whichever political issue the last generation's failed Dark Lord made his personal hobby horse.
Harry glanced significantly at Draco.
The next generation is drawing its own battle lines and forming new alliances. Your son can be frozen out of that, or he can go straight to the top. Is that worth more to you than 40,000 galleons you weren't particularly expecting and don't particularly need?
Harry smiled thinly.
40,000 galleons? 2,000,000 muggle pounds sterling. Your son knows some things about the size of the muggle economy that might surprise you. They'd find it amusing that the fate of a country was revolving around 2,000,000 pounds sterling. They'd think it was cute. And I think much the same, Lord Malfoy. This isn't about me being desperate. This is about you getting a fair chance to be
fair.
Oh? Said Lord Malfoy. And if I refuse your fair chance, what then?
Harry shrugged.
It depends on what sort of coalition government gets put together without the Malfoys. If the government can be reformed peacefully, and it would disturb the peace to do otherwise, I'll pay you the money out of petty cash. Or maybe the Death Eaters will be retired for past crimes and executed as a matter of justice, as a result of due legal process, of course.
You truly are mad,
Lucius Malfoy said quietly.
You have no power, no wealth, and yet you say such things to me.
Yes, it's silly to think I could scare you. After all, you're not a Dementor.
And Harry went on smiling. It looked it up, and apparently a Bezoar would heal almost any poison if you shoved it into someone's mouth fast enough. Maybe that wouldn't repair radiation damage from transfigured polonium, but then again, maybe it would. So, Harry had looked up the freezing points of various acids, and it turned out that sulfuric acid would freeze at just 10 degrees Celsius, which meant Harry could buy a litre of acid on the Muggle market, freeze it solid, and transfigure it down to a tiny little unnoticeable water ice chip to be flipped into someone's mouth and ingested. No Bezoar would compensate for that once the transfiguration wore off. Harry had no intention of saying it out loud, of course, but now that he'd failed decisively to prevent any